This is Anne Andrews, and I'm recording an interview with Kathleen Harnett at her residence at 714 Pacific Avenue in Long Beach. The date is October 27, 1981.
5-acre ranch, which is number 2481 Atlantic now. And we had pigs and chickens and ducks and fruit trees, and the family had canned a whole lot of fruit because a big family, they wanted to have plenty to eat. And Ivy told once about how when she came home from school and hung up her coat under this shelf that had been built to hold the canned fruit, and the shelf broke and the canned fruit came down. And when she finished telling this very dramatic story, Mother said, the interesting part of that story is that it was happened before Ivy was born. And I said, well, I saw Ivy in it too. And I was 4 years later. So, you see, sometimes when the Harnett family, members of the Harnett family, start telling about what the Harnetts did, it may be just what they heard so many times that they got it. But,
when did your family come to Long Beach?
They came to Long Beach in 1889, and they had a 6-month-old baby with them and big family, and then Ivy and Frank and I were born here. People would ask me, are you related to Jane Harnett? And I would say distantly, she was my mother's first child and I was the 13th. She started teaching the year I was born, and I started teaching the year she died, and eventually had the same position that she had, the head of the history department at Polly High. And we lived on this 5-acre ranch, and everybody had 5-acre ranches then. The Shrobes had it to north of us, and the Sanders to the south of us, and we built a tennis court on our place, and eventually we had thousands of pigeons. And the way I earned my spending money was picking squabs for the market. We went to the Burnett School. And then when it was the eighth grade, when I was in the eighth grade, I had to go down to the fifth in Atlantic because Burnett School didn't have an eighth grade. And I remember I used to ride a bicycle down there. It was a dirt road, but I rode a bicycle down there. And one morning, my bicycle tire was flat, so I started walking, and when I crossed Hill Street, the 5-minute bell rang, and so I pinned back my ears and ran down the street as fast as I could go, because if you were late, you had to stay half an hour after school, and we had work to do after school, and I didn't want to stay. And I arrived at the school just as the bell rang for the people to get in line, and then the bell rang to be silent. Well, I could no more be silent than anything, and I had to go up the stairs, and when I get up to the top of the stairs, the teacher sent me to the principal's office. Fortunately, he knew me and knew my family, and so he just told me to sit down. And he evidently wrote to the teacher not to make me stay after school, because when I calmed down and told him that I ran because I didn't want to be late, because and he, of course, he knew I wasn't late because I'd come out of the class. And then I went over to 8th and American, which was then Long Beach High School, and had my 9th, 10th, and 11th grade there. And then it interests me to think that when they began agitating for buying land and building a bigger high school, they were talking about going out to 16th and Atlantic, and people that were opposed to it said, people never go that far out of town to go to school. And but I had my 12th year there at Polly High. And then I went up to Berkeley and worked for a room and board the first 2 years, and then got a scholarship. And then, of course, being up north, I had no connections down here, so I had a hard time getting a job. And finally, somebody told somebody in Arizona, so I got a job in Morenci, Arizona. Taught there for 2 years, and then was principal for 5 years. And then
When did you go to Maryland?
1917, September 1917. Yeah. And then 1924, I came to Pauley, started in the Spanish, teaching Spanish. But I had taught Spanish in Marinci, where everybody talked Spanish, you know, and it was just to correct the grammar of the kids, not the tone. And the senior class put on a play in Spanish for the, and the first year Spanish class put on one act plays to raise money for the Red Cross. It was during the war, of course. And then I came to Long Beach, and nobody knew Spanish, and to pound out the A-E-O-U and the, finally one semester, Mr. Bertram said, we need somebody in the history department. Well, of course, I'd majored in history in college. So I said, well, I'd be glad to. So I taught history class, and as soon as I got started teaching, I said to Mr. Bertram, if you had wanted me to stay in the Spanish department, you should never told me to give me a class in history, because so then I went, was transferred and taught history and became head of the history department.
Did you always want to be a teacher, or was there any other option that you...
No other option that I considered. I had three older sisters who were teachers, and I just didn't... I wanted to go to college. That was one thing I wanted. I did. But I had never considered anything else.
Was your sister Jenny an influence on you?
Oh, I'm sure she was, because I admired her very much. She was a very excellent teacher, and and she seemed to be quite satisfied with that as an occupation, and I had no other particular interest. I wasn't musical. When I sang, I flatted or sharped or changed keys with the greatest of ease. And I wasn't artistic, you know, didn't have any particular bent in that line. So, and then, of course, when you get to college, well, you consider the occupation, well, what are you going to do? So I ended up as a history teacher. One time it interested me, when I was a senior in college, my sister Nora was a missionary and a teacher in a mission school in Ketchikan, Alaska. And she got married, and so they were looking for a new teacher for the school. And so these representatives came to see me and wanted to know if I would be a mission teacher. And I toyed with the idea. I thought, well, you know, I've been studying pretty hard for 4 years. Maybe that would be good to teach a while and kind of absorb what I've learned. But I wrote home. Well, my sister Jane had financed anything I needed extra, you know, clothes and things like that. And I wrote home, and I never got so many letters on one mail ever before or after. And everybody said, no, don't, you know, get your degree, you know, and come back to you. Except Jane, who said, you do what you think would be best for you. So, of course, I thought, well, you know, I don't know what's best for me, but I, you know, after all, I'm not really sort of prepared to teach elementary school, so I went and finished and got my degree and went and taught high school.
What was it like teaching in Arizona?
Well, it was very interesting. Of course, the first year that I taught, I know I studied harder than any kid in school, because I had had 2 years of Latin in high school, and then at that time they required 4 years of Latin to get an A.B. degree. So I took a year of Latin in college in my freshman year. And then I had 2 years of Spanish, and I took Spanish in college. And in college they said that history, any board of education will think anybody can teach history. You've got to just keep a page ahead of the kids and you'll be all right. And So they said Spanish would be good because you got to be prepared on that. So I really got extra preparation. I got a recommended minor in Spanish, and when I taught that first year, I taught first and second year Latin, first and second year Spanish, world history, and American history and government. And that was really a you know, I did have to keep a page of the head of the kids in Latin. I had four boys in that class. But it was very interesting. It was very different from anything that I'd, you know, be in a mining camp. So it was quite interesting. And then, of course, it was the war on in there, so I learned to knit and knit for the Red Cross. And
Was a mining camp in Arizona affected by World War
I
that much?
Well, there were a lot of Welshmen working in the mines. And I know they sang all night, the night of the armistice, they sang. The night of the false armistice, they sang all night, and then they had a singing piano all night the next night when the real armistice came. And, of course, they were sent boys going off to war and all that, so that. But, and of course that's what caused me to knit, was because they wanted to knit goods for the soldiers. And,
You haven't stopped yet, have you?
Oh, no. Now I'm knitting for the church and knitting baby things.
Well, that's
good. Sweater, baby.
That's good.
And, of course, one interesting thing, before I left Polly, they decided that they were going to rotate heads of department. And when I was no longer head of the department, I became in charge of student government, and that was very interesting. And the one thing that interested me, people talk about, oh, I'm not the kind of a person who could get up in front of a lot of people and talk, you know. When I was first made principal of the school in Arizona, there was 85 students in the whole school, which, you know, is a small school. And the superintendent came and introduced me as their new principal. Well, anybody would know. You were supposed to make a remark or two. And you know what I said? Go to your second period class. And that's all I said. And then when I came to Polly High, I said to Mr. Seymour, asked me to help with the scholarship department. And I said, I'll help with the scholarship department if you don't ever make me get up on that stage, because that would be talking to 1,500 or more kids. And before I got to, when I was in charge of student government, I could get out there and talk to the, never battered me, never bothered me a particle. And people at the church, at Midweek Fellowship, people say, you know, it's just amazing for a person, you know, to stand up and talk as easily as you do. To the people in the Midweek Fellowship, it's nothing compared to before Polly High. So, but, you know, you can learn, you can change if you really make up your mind to it. It comes to the point where you have to do it, where you just go ahead and do it. But,
Did you notice any change over the years, and probably not a change in students or their attitudes?
Yes. When I think of, when I was in high school, Polly High, you really respected your teachers, and you know, you toed the mark and really bore down on it. Of course, there probably were some people that didn't, but I know that there were people, always people that monkey around, but it seems to me that when I taught at Polly High, that there were more people that tried to get by with, you know, just slide through, and the attitude that, you know, well, you pass that examination, you don't need to worry about trying to keep anything from that, you know. But, of course, there's one thing. I think that the attitude of the kids in the class are often influenced very much by the attitude of the teacher. And, I know at Polly High, I almost always had Negroes in my class. And they knew that the color of their skin didn't make a bit of difference to me. It was how they behaved and what they did. And I remember one of the things that happened when I was teaching at Polly, a woman came up and said that I can't even remember the date of this, but it was the Girl Scouts of America were having their national convention here in Long Beach, and would I be the moderator for a panel discussion? And on the panel discussion, they were going to have a Chinese or a Japanese, YWCA, YMCA, Girl Scout, Boy Scout, you know, and all that kind of thing. And it was to discuss the problems of people, young people. And one time she came up to me and said that she wanted me to pick the Negro. So I had a Negro boy in my class, and he told me afterwards that that was the most exciting thing, the biggest event in his high school career was that being on that national convention. And she came in to me and she said, will lunch at the Breakers Hotel be all right? This is, of course, was long years ago. And I said, well, do they allow Negroes? And, she said, she never thought of that. So then I got a letter saying that we were to meet in the Breakers Hotel at a certain room. And so we had lunch up in the private rooms of the officers of the Girl Scouts of America. And the 17 magazine, for example, had a photographer there, and they made poor Wesley. Wesley was sitting between two white girls on the Davenport, and the president, who was a Southerner, was handing him a cup of coffee. Well, she handed him about five cups of coffee, or did it about five times, because everybody wanted a picture of this Southern woman giving a cup of coffee to a Negro boy. But,
I didn't ever realize that there would have been that kind of segregation in Long Beach. How long ago was that?
Well, it was.
In the
30s? I guess it probably was, because I started in 24.
Yeah.
And,
so there were restaurants and hotels in Long Beach that didn't allow Negroes to eat in the dining room?
Oh, yes. Yes, one time. Oh, now this was at the time, you remember there used to be a Welch's on Atlantic?
Yes, yes.
And then there was it Brower's?
Yeah.
On Pacific?
Yes.
And I was a sponsor for the Future Teachers of America Club. And every year we'd have a banquet at a restaurant. And the night before, we were to have our banquet at Brower's. They called up and wanted to know if there was a Negro in the group. And I said, no, there was no Negro. There was a Japanese. Well, Japanese was all right, but the Negroes, they wouldn't allow in the dining room. And I thought, well, I'm never again going to Brower's with a bunch of kids, because I'm not going to have that, you know. And because this was before the war, so the Japanese were all right. So the next year I called Welch's, and Welch's, I had two Negroes in there, and it made no difference to Welch's, and all those Negro girls, they thought they were really right in there with the, because Welch's was a very lovely restaurant, and we had reservations in the garden room, so that they thought it was wonderful. Oh, yeah, it was.
Where did most of the Negro families live in Long Beach at that time?
Well, I guess about where most of them do now, what you call a central city.
Yeah.
That would be where most of them were. And so Polly had more Negroes than, I don't know that Wilson or Jordan had any at that time. Of course, then it shifted, you know, and now they've spread pretty widely. But, of course, I retired before all that problem of the Negroes, you know, the race. And but, you know, the thing that interests me is that at the time when there was this very bitter feeling at Polly High, there's some people that were scared to death to go there, and others that went there and didn't know anything was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that so often people react to you the way you act towards them, and so you never can be sure just what the situation is unless you know the person pretty well to know what they do it. But of course, I remember one time there was a Negro woman taught a Sunday school class in our church, and she had children. And at that time we had neighborhood groups, discussion groups, and I would go over and pick up this woman, and we would go out to the discussion group in Bixby Knowles. And when the riots and, you know, the trouble started in Watts, it had already started, but I thought, you know, it was all right. I wasn't afraid of. But when I took her home, there were four or five Negro boys in the street. And so she several times said, well, good night, Kathleen. Thank you. I enjoyed visiting with you and something like that, you know, so that the boys would know that I was not, she was not the maid that I was taking home, and I was the white boss, you know. So I got out of that, but then we decided after that I'd better not drive into that area again. But it just is amazing. I remember this Wesley that was on the Girl Scout discussion group. I don't know who they still is, but SCAM, the organization in Long Beach, came up to, well, they had talked to the Midweek Fellowship once before, but this is a new person, and he thought that would be a good place to talk. And they went to the office, and the office said, well, go to the parish hall and talk to Miss Harnett. And Wesley said, did she teach at Pauley High? And they said, yes. And he said, oh, they won't remember. She won't remember me. And he was so tickled when he came in and remembered it. And to my amazement, last year, I went into Newbury's to buy some buttons for my baby sweaters. And the girl at the check where I was paying for them said, did you teach at Pauley High? I said, yes, 26 years ago. And she said, you haven't changed a bit. And I said, oh, my land, 26 years. And she said, my brother and I were talking about the other day, and I said, was your brother's name Wesley? And she said, yes. Well, Wesley, of course, had seen me the only Negro brother and sister that would be talking about me would be Wesley and his sister. So, but that's one thing I've never been able to understand in people, that they get so upset about races and like that, you know. I'm a great person for live and let live.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let people be themselves as long as they're trying to gain their potential. But, of course, Long Beach used to be very different. When we were children, we used to pack up in the horse and wagon and go down and spend a day on the beach, you know. And it was a long beach then, and very little on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really wonderful. And that was a regular thing to do, just to go down, especially 4th of July, go down there and have a great time. And we'd go swimming, and but it's very different. Even the physical shape of the beach has changed so enormously. And, of course, the buildings and everything. I remember there used to be that, what did they call it down there on every Sunday? They'd have these. My father was a great man for the church. He would walk down to early service at St. Luke's. Then he'd walk over to, then he'd go down on the pier and listen to whatever that went on. Then he'd go to the Talvin Bible class. Then he'd come back to the 11 o'clock service at St. Luke's. And then we'd all go home together. Of course, in the early days, we'd have put some hay in the back of the wagon and put a blanket over, and then we'd sit on it down there. And then he'd go to the local Baptist church on Hill Street, Hill and Lime, like they're all live, and in the evening. But and we
It was your brother Tom, who was the first senior warden of St.
Louis? He was the senior warden for about 25 years. They didn't have as many changes. In fact, the way that, you know, Pickles Hall,
yes,
mother played the organ, and when they came from England, Jane and Tom came. They came in with the family,
yes,
with all the family. That is, except the three that were born in here. But Jack and Apple stayed in England with relatives because they hadn't finished their education. They were in the middle of education, and of course Jane and Tom hadn't really finished theirs either. But they were not. They weren't in the middle of something. And when Ethel and Jack came out, I don't know whether they organized it, but they were a very strong force in the choir in Pickles Hall. And then they, of course, went to Fifth and Locust with the St. Luke's. And once our horse had run away, and he was found standing at the pitching post in by the church. That was where they found him.
He knew where he,
when he got lost, well, he knew that was one place he knew. But we had some, the horse and buggy days were really something. I remember once Josephine was driving, and this was the days when everybody had long hair and lots of hairpins. And we had a horse that was very skittish. And a man in a fancy rubber-tired rig and a fancy horse passed us. Well, Tommy would not let anybody pass him, so he tore down. And so we came down what was Long Beach Boulevard. It was American Avenue then. And finally, when we got towards town, 4th Street or something like that, the man turned around and thought, you know, enough's enough. And here was Josie, tears pouring down her face, her hair flying, all the hairpins gone. And the man, of course, looked